When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Welcome back to another sparkling edition of The Thought Police. We are in week three of lockdown. Matt Kelly is in another part of the world. I'm in London. Matt, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Hello, Mike. How are you, mate?
I'm okay. You know, we were hopeful that last week we were going to be able to do a second podcast, but it didn't work out in the end because of various logistical things that go wrong in this day and age. I mean, we were about to record this, and suddenly the engineer appeared and said, oh, I just have to restart something. And I'm like, right, okay then. You know, luckily, we've all got lots of time on our hands. So, you know.
Well, I wish that was true. I've never been busier.
Really? Why is that?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot going on in the world of local newspapers.
Yes.
Trying to keep the businesses alive, basically, because obviously people aren't going out to buy newspapers as much as they were. And we don't make much money as of now from the websites that everyone is suddenly using. So it's tough out there. It was tough before this, but it's becoming very, very tough now in the local news. So before we go any further, I would just say if you do pass a news agent, nip in and buy a paper, especially a local one if you can.
Well, one of the things that at least people can still do if they're still going into supermarkets is they can do that, can't they? They can still buy their paper. I don't know how much of your local sales are actually in supermarkets, but
Well, actually, supermarkets is where it's fallen off the most, because some supermarkets have been saying we don't want to stock local papers anymore and making it difficult.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, although I think there was an idea that somehow papers were another thing that were dangerous because, you know, paper boy might have handed it to you and or it's been put on the stack. You know, it's just another thing to touch.
But yes.
According to the World Health Organization, they're absolutely safe as anything, you know. So you can read your local paper and it's full of great news and you'll miss them when they're gone.
Was it the Mail that years ago, or when they first put Metro out or something, that they did some gimmick with gloves, didn't they? Because there was a newsprint problem or something where people were getting, their hands were getting all black, and so you could get a free pair of gloves or something to read the newspaper with. I can't remember when that was. But I'll tell you what, I saw something frightening today on Facebook, and you've probably seen it as well, some sales figures where I'm told The Guardian is currently down to 62,000 a day, right?
No,
and The Mirror apparently is down to a daily sale of just about 300,000. And the word is that there's going to be furloughs for staff and there's going to be 20% pay cuts for executives and all sorts of stuff. So, I mean, this is not a joke.
It's not a joke. I read that today, that they're putting 20% of their staff on furlough.
Right.
We've put people on furlough as well.
Yeah.
You know, sports reporters, a lot of sports reporters haven't got that much to do now.
So. No, exactly. And how are you finding that system? You may not be involved in it, but I mean, I'm interested because I'm talking to a lot of people on the radio who are falling between the cracks. You know, like, for example, there's this situation where somebody who was hired to start their new job after February the 28th, basically doesn't qualify for furlough because they weren't there. And of course, the government had to set the date somewhere because otherwise people would just sort of, you know, claim to be in a new job, which they want 80% money for. But I've had quite a few people say, you know, the government advice is to go back to your old employer and say, re-employ me. But of course, old employers don't want to do that.
No, that's terrible. Mm. I mean, I hadn't really thought of that too much, but you're right. And I think freelancers, you know, who are dependent on a wide variety of income from people, they're going to see, a lot of people see that collapse.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people who have fallen through the cracks.
And I think the government, and you know, you and I will disagree probably on the way the government have run this thing anyway. But I mean, I think the government does need to plug these gaps because finance is very important. And what I was going to ask you is, do you know whether those people that you've put on furlough are getting the money?
Yeah, they will do, definitely, because our company will guarantee it. Mm. And the people that in our company, they were all volunteers, basically.
Right.
So, you know, if you have got less to do, then I always find there's nothing more stressful than being in a job and feeling underworked.
Yes.
You know, I get incredibly anxious and guilty. So if that was my situation, and unfortunately it's not, I'm run off my feet. Mm. But if it was, I would prefer to take the small hit in salary and take the furlough.
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, hopefully a lot of people will take the opportunity to either volunteer and do something maybe that they can do within the NHS, or they can volunteer something else, because there's a lot of services that people who have got time on their hands can do for the vulnerable people in the community. I don't want to start sounding like Joan of Arc here, you know, but I think there's...
I don't think there's any danger of that, mate.
Thank you very much indeed. But, you know, I can tell you this, though. I've been doing my bit on Sunday, right? I didn't go out at all.
Not good for you. Saturday
I put the bin out, right? And that was my only kind of that was my only sort of allowance for because I had to put the bin out because it was getting a bit stinky. And then as I walked outside on Saturday, it was a nice day. It was very surprising to me that there were still loads of people walking around, you know?
Yeah.
And I live in a very relatively leafy, quiet part of London, opposite Canary Wharf, down by the river. And all these people are walking around and cycling. Yeah. And then on Sunday, there was a lot fewer. So I think when Matt Hancock said, you know, this is not a joke, you know, if you don't stop doing this, we're going to make it impossible for you to go out altogether.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's going to happen in the next week or two. And I just can't understand what the hell is wrong with these people. It's not like... We, you know, all of this stuff about thank you for staying in, you know, you are, and the Queen's message, which I thought was great, but,
brilliant.
You know, this generation of Britons is as good as any. Well, I'm sorry, that is not being tested. No one's dropping bombs on our heads. You know, the house next door isn't getting annihilated.
Right.
So, you know, and, the threat of Nazi hordes 13 miles across the channel aren't there either.
Mm.
All they're asking you to do is stay in and watch bloody telly.
I know.
Hardly a sacrifice.
But all of these nutters who are going on and on and on about, you know, our civil liberties are being impinged upon. I mean, really? Are you joking?
Yeah.
You're being asked to stay inside, and it's probably not going to last forever. I had Peter Hitchens on the show today because we got into a bit of a Twitter spat overnight, because I said, look, why don't you sit down and shut up? You know, you don't know what you're talking about. Stop encouraging people to go outside, you know. And, of course, he did his usual thing where, you know, well, I would get you to invite me onto your radio show, but you probably decline. I'm like, well, you're wrong. Yeah. The funniest thing about it, right, though, this is going to kill you. The funny, because you know how seriously he takes himself. He's one of these guys. He's like Liam Gallagher. He doesn't actually follow anyone on Twitter. So he follows zero people. So I put out a tweet just after midnight saying, OK, and I did a screenshot of our conversation. I said, well, it looks like this is going to happen. We'll have him on just after midday. Because he doesn't follow me, he didn't see it, right? So I wake up this morning and he's tweeting some bloke in Peru who's got a very similar handle to mine, but not me, called Luis Romero or something, right? Saying, can somebody please ask Mike Graham why he's saying he's not putting me on his radio show when I agreed to do it? This poor bloke's been getting literally thousands of notifications, right? Because everyone's tweeting Hitchens to say, it's not Mike Graham. You're tweeting a guy in Lima, you maniac, you know. Just incredible. And I said it to him on the air. I said, look, you're painting yourself as the seeker of all knowledge and, the, you know, the man that knows everything. I said, you've been tweeting a bloke in Peru most of the morning thinking it was me. You know, why would I take you seriously about whether you should go out or not?
I've always thought Peter Hitchens' biggest problem is that he's nowhere near as smart as his brother was. And I think growing up in Christopher Hitchens' shadow has left a mark on him.
I think so. And I think he'd probably admit that to you himself. But I did actually manage to make him laugh at the end, you know. And he made a funny and I made a funny reference to the Peruvian guy on the air. But, I mean, he admitted on the air as well. He said, well, I don't have a sense of humour, which is very true. He really doesn't. But it was all good stuff. But the thing is, you know, this nonsense about how we're not doing it right. I mean, we still don't know. Sweden, which people are talking about at the moment as having the right attitude because they're letting people walk around and the herd mentality, the herd immunity and all that. Nobody knows if that's going to work. You know, you won't
but
know.
They're starting to shit. They're shitting themselves now.
Yeah, I know. I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. I think they've got it hopelessly wrong, because there are signs now that Spain and Italy are levelling off and coming down, and we're not that far behind them in that graph. So it may, and God knows what's going to happen, but it may get better quicker. You know, I hope so.
It might well. I mean, the problem is that as I look at these graphs that they keep putting together, and of course everybody talks about South Korea as being the one down below, but apart from South Korea, everybody else is on the same trajectory, no matter what they're doing, right?
Yeah, everybody.
You know, just firing massively upwards.
I mean, the one that is going to be shocking is the States.
I think so.
Really, when it really hits them hard, because they've got such a large population, and you know, it's going to be several thousands of people dying a day when they hit peak. And that's going to be a real challenge.
And, I mean, old Donald Trump, right? There's going to be a lot of death. A lot of death. He's just, I expected him next to say, but it's going to be great death. You know, it's going to be the best death you've ever had. It's fantastic death.
That bit about his face mask. You know, I can't sit behind the resolute desk. We're great dictators coming into Washington and wear a face mask. I don't see it. Just don't see it. It's like, are dictators really still popping into the White House these days?
Yeah, what? I suspect they're probably not. Have you seen, I've only just seen this today, an open letter to the president written by Motley Crue's drummer Tommy Lee, you know, the guy who used to shag Pamela Anderson.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievable. I mean, we know a lot more about him than we probably should.
What did he say?
Well, the letter starts from the drummer of Motley Crue, an open letter to the president. Dear fucking lunatic. And it basically says,
wonderful.
At your recent press conference, more a word salad than had a stroke and fell downstairs. You were clearly so out of your depth you needed scuba gear. Within minutes of going off air, your minions were backpedaling faster than Cirque du Soleil acrobats. In India a week ago, I couldn't get past the bit about your being the most popular visitor in the history of fucking India. And it just goes on like that, you know.
Brilliant.
I'm going to tweet it out later on, but
I think it's interesting. I think this might do for Trump, you know, where it was because his big thing was the economy, you know, doing so well and unemployment being so low and all of this. And this has completely scuppered all of that. So.
Yeah. Oh, well, they've already got like 6 million unemployed now. They're going to have something like 14 million. But interestingly enough, they're taking... I was talking to my son in California because he's having to take unemployment because he's lost his job at the shop where he was working. And they're actually paying people $1,200 a month just in cash, straight out. No questions asked, effectively. All you do is you go and sign on and everybody gets the cash payment. It's being debated there as to whether that's a better idea than what we're doing, you know, by furloughing people.
Yeah, well, I think there's something to be said for it, you know, because then that would, you know, we were talking earlier about freelancers and stuff. That would cover that problem.
Yeah, it would. But, I mean, the problem is, Matt, the economy is going to be so screwed that it almost has to recover, because there's no way that it won't recover, in my view. And this is what I say to people like Peter Hitchens, who are very doom and gloom about the economy. You know, the economy won't die. And the reason it won't die is because it's going to be so in hock to the government that the government is going to have to save it.
Yeah, I mean it's impossible that the economy can die, because we will go back to making things and buying things and moving things around the country, but I think it is going to be on its absolute knees by the time we come out of this.
Yeah, although bits of it I suppose, because you know, for example, the food business. I mean, I went, normally on a Saturday I go to Borough Market. I didn't go this week, so I didn't have to drive there, because on Friday I went to a shop, a supermarket down in Greenwich, a Waitrose as it happens, and it had everything I needed to get. So the days of the kind of empty shelves seem to have disappeared from what I can see.
Yeah, no, I read that they're getting back to stock. The thing that bugs me, because our kids drink milk like it's going out of fashion, so being able to get UHT milk is the last sort of sense of sacrifice I'm experiencing.
Yes. You mentioned that. I guess what you're going to have to do is start sending the kids shopping, right? Because if you're only allowed to buy 3 things, you know, you're going to have to all start to go individually shopping, which kind of defeats the object, doesn't it?
It does. It doesn't seem like it's quite in the blitz spirit that we're all meant to be adhering to.
How are the kids doing, by the way, without wishing to get too personal?
It's fine. It's a weird thing, isn't it? Because you don't normally spend this much time cooped up together.
Yeah.
And so I would say to you, the first sort of 10 days was pretty rough for all of us, as we kind of sort of adjusted to each other's company.
Right.
But they have settled into a bit of a groove now, you know, and we've all compromised a bit on how we expect each other to live. So
yes.
You know, I don't get so wound up by my eldest's music now, right. The fact that he's on his Xbox all the time.
Right.
He does some homework now, and he's got, you know, we've got some discipline about that now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we spend a bit of time in the garden and painting. And,
right.
You know, so that's been, there are many nice things about this.
Yeah.
If
you've got a garden, it's great. You know, my kids were, I mean, I spent a lot of time on FaceTime and house party and stuff like that this weekend. And I had a chat with my older son in California, as I say, where his sister's in Dubai. Yeah. They've got total lockdown now in Dubai.
I saw that.
So much so that, do you know what they've done? They've actually zero rated the radar cameras, you know, the traffic speed cameras, so that if you even move, you're getting a ticket.
Is that right?
Yeah, they put it at zero.
What a good idea.
Well, you know, and I said to her, she was like, you know, I'm not sure if I'm still allowed out. She said, we're not really allowed out for a run, but I'm not sure if I can do without that. I said, look, Dubai is not the place where you want to break the curfew, trust me.
No.
You know, and so I don't think she's going to. But she's having more trouble probably than most members of my family because, as I think I've said to you before, she's only ever worked. She's never not really worked. And although they're still producing a show out there, she's not going anywhere. So she's having to sit in her palatial 41st floor apartment with a balcony overlooking the Burj, whatever it's called, you know.
Yeah,
and I said to her, you know, you're not really in terrible shape, darling. You know, you're getting paid, still working. You've got Waitrose that delivers to you. You know, just deal with it.
Fantastic. I mean, I think people have got to take... We're never going to get this opportunity again where we're going to have this amount of time, you know, to do something. So I would say do what, you know, learn that language that you always thought about, learn to play the piano, read Ulysses by James Joyce. You know, that's been on my list for about 40 years now and I've never got around to it. Well, I might do now.
Yeah, right. Well, do you know what? My food podcast that I told you I was going to start, I kicked it off this week. And actually it's going really well. People are really liking it. People are kind of getting into it. A couple of people started cooking from it. So we're going to do basically two, and it's just me in the kitchen, literally talking into my iPhone.
Did you find it? Because obviously the TV chefs make it sound and feel very easy. Did you find actually do it talking while you were cooking and all of that? Was it easy to do? Could you fill the time?
Well, do you know, when I first started doing it, I thought this is going to be really tough because one of the things that I found was that I was actually out of breath doing it, right?
Right.
And I thought to myself, either I've got bloody coronavirus or I'm going to have to change the way that I do, because normally I'm sitting at a microphone like I am now and I'm not moving around. But when you start moving around, suddenly it's a different sort of dynamic, you know? So...
Yeah.
I started doing it, and the first sort of recording I made, I thought, this is awful. This is really bad. And then I kind of got more into it and got more used to it and basically just pretended that I was talking to somebody in the room rather than into a microphone, and that made it a lot easier. But you can hear, like, all the sounds. So you can hear, like, the onions, you know, frying in the pan. You can hear the bubbling of the potato. I mean, it's a remarkably rounded experience, in fact, you know?
It was spaghetti bolognese, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And also the idea I'm going to have is that I'm not going to try and show off. I'm not going to try and do fancy stuff. But a lot of people, believe it or not, actually don't know how to cook anything because they've never been taught. So I'm basically teaching them more than anything else and having little tidbits. Like I've got one coming out midweek. I'm going to do little sort of almost tutorials, how to mash potatoes, which I know is going to sound ridiculously stupid to anyone who knows how to mash potatoes. But if you've never done it, you know, you kind of go, oh, that's what you do. And people are frightened of it, you know?
My favourite cooking story was when Marco Pierre White did the recipe column for the Daily Mirror.
Yeah.
Because Piers used to go around getting all these columnists that could get him something, you know, so Marco Pierre White could get him a great table at all his restaurants and that. So Marco became the Daily Mirror's cooking correspondent.
Because he's right up their street, isn't he?
Yeah, no, totally. So as features editor, I was responsible for dealing with his copy.
Right.
And one came in and it was white truffle lobster linguine.
Oh, right? Yes,
and,
of course.
And it started by saying, take two live lobsters, right?
Right.
So you can imagine the Mirror readers on a Saturday morning going, you what?
Yeah, well, yeah.
And we priced it up and it came to something like 62 quid a head, right?
Well,
and
just to cook it at home.
Yeah, we went to Piers and said, look, I'm not being funny, mate. We know that he's got incredible cachet and all of that, but this recipe costs you £62 a portion.
Right.
So Piers phoned Marco and said, look, you know, you're taking the piss a bit here. Right. These are mirror readers, you know, they're salt of the earth people, ordinary working class people. They don't have, you know, white truffle lobster linguine. They don't even know what a white truffle is. So Marco said, okay, Piers, understood, leave it with me. And then the next week, the recipe came in, and it was beans on toast. take one tin of Heinz baked beans.
Right. I bet he was unloading quite a lot of money for that column as well, because I seem to remember when I was back in the Express in the 90s, he was always in the news for one reason or another. He was either with the wrong woman or he was having a fight at his ex-wife threw him out, I think, one point, and there was like fighting going on outside the house. It was hilariously kind of mad.
Yeah. And he's sort of gone off the board. Gordon Ramsay kind of stole his thunder a bit, I think, didn't he? In terms of celebrity chef stuff.
I always
quite liked Marco Pierre White because he was always a bit, you always felt, he was a bit like the Eric Cantona of the kitchen, you know, you just never knew what he was going to come out with next.
Yeah, that's right. And they are famously, most chefs that I've ever met, famously crazy. And funnily enough, that guy that we met at Piers's party, James Chiaverini, he came on, he listened to the podcast, thought it was great because he's got two restaurants in Kensington, right? But he's the guy who shoots his own food, right? He goes down to Sussex and shoots deer and pheasant and all that. He says, I've got a better one than that. He said, you can do one of your podcasts, you can come with me down to Sussex and we can shoot some stuff and then cook it.
That's great.
It'd be great. But of course, who knows when that's going to happen? I mean, I'm hearing, as I'm sure you are, that this week is the sort of the key week, basically, that one week from now, we might know an awful lot more about whether this has peaked and whether we have been or we will be able to move on, in which case, you know, I've said to my kids, you never know, you might be able to go back to school in sort of June or something, you know?
Yeah. But what do you think is, so say it does peak this week and we start to see some declines, what's your reading of what happens next? I know no one knows for sure, but what do you think will happen?
Well, do you know what's interesting to me? And I was talking to my sister over the weekend who works in the kind of consulting business. There's consultants crawling around all over this, right? People from Deloitte, people from Accenture, people from all sorts of other companies are working with governments around the world, right? So they're logistically sort of, you know, what do they call it? War gaming, all of this stuff, right? So they're working inside of Whitehall. They're working inside of the White House. They're working inside of, I know, Mario Cuomo's office in New York State. And so they're coming up with basically whatever is this exit plan and how it's going to work, you know, and what you say, for example, to restaurant owners who have had their restaurants shut for 2 months. Do you then say to them, well, you can now open up your restaurants? I just don't know. I wonder whether they might move to a kind of a situation where they start to protect the more vulnerable people only. And they start to tell other people that they can move around. But of course, again, you have a problem because if you look at what happened, for example, in Florida in a spring break, right, in February, somebody in America has done a kind of a flow chart of where all those people went. And literally all the kids who were down on beaches, you know, snogging each other and kissing each other and pouring beer all over each other, have literally flown to every other state in America.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So even places where they didn't have it much have now got it.
I guess they might say, you know, this age group can now go back to work if you work in these sectors or something like that. Or they might try to, they might say, you know, right, the Northwest will start to, you know, reduce restrictions there. But I can't help feeling that they will be very reluctant to do anything like that for many weeks.
Yes.
Because, of course, as soon as you, like you've just said, the minute you relax the restrictions, until we've got a vaccine, it's all going to start flaring up again.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And some people have, again, called the show and said to me, you know, well, in certain parts of Wales, there's not very much of it, so why can that not be, you know, taken out of lockdown? And I said, well, because if people from there then go somewhere else and they bring it back, then suddenly you've got it again, you know?
Yeah.
It's very difficult to know, really.
You see that tiger that's gone?
Yeah.
I thought that was quite chilling, the fact that it can jump species from humans
because they
animals.
Say yeah because I heard a guy on the radio the other day saying it won't do that because the virus likes the human sort of body form for whatever reason. It doesn't need to go to another form of species because it might not be as successful, so viruses would normally stay where they like to be. So that's
what,
all so
that's the
all
virus is sitting there going I'm not jumping to a tiger.
Well, this guy's argument was, look, if it's successfully killing people, why would it jump to a tiger, which it might not be able to kill? I don't know. I think my dog might have it. I told you about the dog, didn't I?
Yeah.
The dog, I mean, has got some kind of chest infection. So the dog might have it. You see, my entire family might have had it, which makes
I'll
it incredibly...
Let me just outdo Peter Hitchens with some kind of cataclysmic, like, doom and gloom. It could. We don't know how this is going to end. It could, like, never go away. You know, this could be the end of civilization as we know it.
Or just the way that civilization is going to be, rather than the end. I mean, I'm like you.
That's what I mean. You know,
I'm like you.
Everything might have to change. Everything might have to change.
Yeah.
And frankly, if we have to continue with this level of human interaction, I'll be absolutely delighted.
Well, it's absolutely right. I mean, I'm not missing going to the pub in the way that I thought that I would. Right. I'm constantly surprised at how everybody is dealing with it, despite the sort of occasional crazy people who complain that they, you know, they can't go out and, you know, their lives are over. Actually, I'm really surprised at how calm everybody is.
Yeah.
You know?
What's the biggest thing you've missed in the last sort of 2.5-3 weeks?
Probably human contact. Just, you know, the physical contact of hugging somebody, you know?
Yeah.
Because apparently you can't do that in the office anymore. Which kind of disappoints me. Although that's got nothing to do with the coronavirus. But, you know, I haven't actually hugged another human being since this lockdown. So we're basically talking 3 weeks. So since the last time I was in Sussex, when I was hugging the dog and the kids and their mother as well, you know, nothing.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? That?
But it's not making me, it's not driving me to despair. You know, I don't wake up in the morning and feel like, oh my God, this is so awful. I can't manage. Yeah.
I think what I've missed is the kind of distinction between weekdays and weekends.
Yeah.
You know, they're starting to blur into one another.
Well, now. See, I'm lucky because I still have the week where I'm coming into work. So I'm still physically getting up at 7 a.m, getting into the car, driving into the office, you know, which I hope will long continue. But you know what the other thing is, and I don't know how much of this you did as a younger reporter, but I spent a lot of time in cars doorstepping people, right?
Yeah.
For years, both in America, in this country, in Spain, in various other parts of the world, you know. And I've stood around waiting for something to happen and watching nothing happen for hours and sometimes for days. And I wonder whether that kind of has prepared me for this, you know?
Your ability to witness nothing happening on a sustained basis.
Yeah, and also, I mean, social media helps a lot because, you can be on your own now and you're never on your own, if you know what I mean. I mean, I spent a good part of yesterday, probably about 4 continuous hours, talking to somebody on the phone or on my FaceTime, you know?
Yeah.
So suddenly I looked up and it was like 7:30 at night and I hadn't had any dinner and I was like, oh, great, you know.
Let's switch topic.
Yeah.
Keir Starmer.
Yes.
What do you think?
I think he's an absolute waste of space. I think this is a guy. Yeah. I think he's Mr. Nobody. I don't know what he believes in. I've got no idea what his conviction politics are, apart from that he'd like to stay in the European Union and he wishes we still were in it.
Yeah. I really like him, obviously, for those reasons. But I also think he's very electable. You know, I think he looks the part.
Yeah. I don't think he does. I don't think he comes across at all well. He's kind of got this kind of startled look about him.
Right, yes. No, he does have a sort of...
You know, like you've just found him doing something he shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, but I think, you know, he's got 3 years, 3 or 4 years now to get to the point where he really has that sort of Blair-esque magnetism. So if he can do a bit of media training and they coach him, I think... He is very intelligent and he's very articulate. The problem is that he talks a little bit like the barrister
That is the trouble. Yeah. And he is a barrister. Yeah. You know what I think of barristers?
Yeah.
You know, they all think they're very clever and they all think they can tie everybody up in knots. But in fact, in politics, it's not about being clever. It's about being smart, which is a very different thing, you know?
That's right. I think that's a very interesting observation, that there are so many very clever people, not just in politics, but people who don't get as far as you'd imagine they would because they're not smart. And there is a big difference.
I mean, look at Nicola Sturgeon. I was really amazed at Nicola Sturgeon at the weekend. You know, this woman, Catherine, whatever her name is, the chief medical officer, goes off to Fife, not once, but twice, right? And Nicola Sturgeon appears on the stage with her at a press conference and defends her. And I'm watching it and I was tweeting out going, this woman ain't going to last a day. She can't possibly last the day. Everybody's asking her the same question. You know, why did you break the law? And saying to Nicola Sturgeon, did she tell you she was going to break the law? I mean, I'm surprised in a way that Sturgeon survived it.
It's amazing. Have you seen those funny videos where someone's dubbed over them in a very heavy Glaswegian accent?
No.
Oh, they're hilarious.
Oh, you mean Nicola the Sturgeon ones? Yes, I have seen some of those. Yeah. She actually, she goes, to her credit, she actually acknowledged them and said they were quite funny. Right.
You're busting my head, you fucking idiot.
Well, I mean, I used to know her quite well. We used to drink champagne together in Regano's, you know, when I was up there. And you know, now she doesn't answer my calls. Funny enough. But you know,
she in the old days?
She was great fun. She was like the sort of deputy leader of the SNP in Scotland to Salmond, which is another story altogether, I suppose, that we didn't know about at the time. But no, she was a right old laugh, you know. I because we almost at one point at the Scottish Mirror, you might not know this, got into bed with the SNP because I'd said to Piers, you know, this is a really bad idea supporting the Labour Party in Scotland because they are screwing it up, you know, in spades, and we should be backing the SNP. And funnily enough, it got to the stage where we were talking to senior figures in the SNP, including her, about how we would do it. And this was for the Scottish election, I think, rather than the general. And then suddenly Mark Hollinshead appeared in my door one day. This is when he was the managing director of the Record and Sunday Mail. And he said, I've just had a call from Victor Blank. I said, oh, yeah. He said, he wants to know why you're back in the SNP.
Yeah.
And I said, what's it got to do with you? He said, well, he's asked me to ask you. I said, well, I don't talk to you. I said, you have to talk to Piers Morgan about that. I'm not giving you any information at all. Fuck off. I mean, you know, why were we surprised that as soon as he became the boss down in London, he shut the Scottish Mirror?
but Mark has got the thickest skin of any newspaper executive I've ever known.
Well, he proved that by falling through a glass coffee table not too many days later from that particular conversation. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And he's survived massively well, considering, you know, all the places he's been and all the various kind of problems that have happened there.
I like him a lot. He started with my dad on the Birmingham Post as a marketing executive.
Yeah, funny.
My dad was the editor. It was his first gig, I think, straight out as a uni.
Right.
But he used to put up with torrid screaming matches from Sly Bailey.
Yeah, I bet.
Who was the chief executive and quite a character. We must talk about...
We should talk about her, yeah. What's this in between her ordering shoes and clothes and things to be delivered to the office?
Honestly, I've got so many good stories about Sly.
Oh, we must do that. Well, what do you think the chance... We're coming to the end now, so what do you think the chances are of doing a second one this week?
I think they're probably limited to non-existent.
I'm quite happy to just do one, but we just I don't want to tell people we're going to do two if we're not going to do two, so why don't we just do one then?
I think for the duration we'll have a bit of social distancing between our podcasts.
Okay, now let me ask you one final question before I let you go. Have you got a tennis court? I saw this on Facebook and thought to myself, surely the champagne socialist Matt Kelly doesn't now have a tennis court.
So I live on a place that used to be a borstal, right?
And
in about 1968, it got converted into really nice, like, flats, you know. So, and we live in what was the supervisor, the governor's little bungalow, you know, on the side.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely, lovely area. It's about 2 minute walk down to the river and it's so peaceful and it's only 15 minutes from Norwich. But on site is a tennis court. So yeah, I do.
That's amazing.
In a manner of speaking.
That's amazing. Are you any good?
Am I any good?
Yeah.
No, I'm hopeless.
Right.
But my kids are pretty good.
I used to be quite good at tennis, believe it or not. One of these days we'll have a game.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
I'll come and visit you.
I'm getting plenty of practice.
Brilliant stuff. Well, listen, take care of yourself, and we'll be seeing you.
Stay safe.
We'll be seeing everybody at the same time next week. Take it easy.
Yeah. Take care.
I'm really surprised at how calm everybody is.
Yeah.
You know,
what's the biggest thing you've missed in the last sort of 2.5-3 weeks?
Probably human contact. Just, you know, the physical contact of hugging somebody. You know, because apparently you can't do that in the office anymore, which kind of disappoints me. Although that's got nothing to do with the coronavirus. But, you know, I haven't actually hugged another human being since this lockdown. So we're basically talking 3 weeks. So since the last time I was in Sussex,
Yeah.
When I was hugging the dog and the kids and their mother as well, you know, nothing.
Yeah, it's weird,
but,
isn't it, that?
But it's not making me, it's not driving me to despair. You know, I don't have, I don't wake up in the morning and feel like, oh my God, this is so awful, I can't manage.
I think what I've missed is the kind of distinction between weekdays and weekends.
Yeah.
You know, they're starting to blur into one another.
Well,
now.
See, I'm lucky because I still have the week where I'm coming into work, so I'm still physically getting up at 7 in the morning, getting into the car, driving into the office, you know, which I hope will long continue. But you know what the other thing is, and I don't know how much of this you did as a younger reporter, but I spent a lot of time in cars doorstepping people, right?
Yeah.
For years, both in America, in this country, in Spain, in various other parts of the world, you know. And I've stood around waiting for something to happen and watching nothing happen for hours and sometimes for days. And I wonder whether that kind of has prepared me for this, you know?
Your ability to witness nothing happening.
Yeah.
On a sustained basis.
Yeah.
Keir Starmer.
Yes.
What do you think?
I think it's an absolute waste of space.